You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The American military's decision to change tactics with a surge in 2006 followed a major battle within its ranks as to whether to change course in Iraq. Thomas E. Ricks describes both the fight within the Pentagon and the campaign on the ground in his book, The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iran. Which was published in hardcover last year. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, contributing editor for Foreign Policy magazine, and a special military correspondent for the Washington Post. An updated edition of The Gamble is now out in paperback from Penguin, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Ricks back to our show. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, I hope that won't be seen as a Freudian slip. Iraq's parliamentary...
That's going to be one of my next books, I guess.
Iraq's parliamentary elections are scheduled for next month. How important will these elections be?
I think these are huge. These will really tell us the shape of post-American Iraq, whether this trend of it slowly falling apart will continue, or whether we'll finally achieve the political breakthrough that was promised by the surge. I mean, this, I was thinking as I was driving in today that this really might be where we find out whether the surge worked, quote-unquote, as people say, in the sense that it led to what it was promised to lead to, which was a political breakthrough in Iraq.
Can you talk a bit about the legal battle over the decision, initial decision to ban more than 500 candidates who had ties to Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist Party?
Yeah, this is kind of been a political back and forth. It's worrisome not so much for the legal precedence and situation as it is for the signal it sends to the Sunni community that the Shiites really think they've won. They don't want you participating in the election. And even if you do participate, they're not going to give you any power you win in the election. If that plays out, then this is going to be a very messy year in Iraq.
Is it ironic that in past elections, many Sunni groups boycotted the procedures, and now they want to be in?
No, it's just it's symptomatic of the problem of post-Saddam Iraq, which is that the Shiites' attitude is, it's our country now, we own it, just like you guys treated us for decades, that you had the country and you owned it. And it's also symptomatic of the fact that the basic questions facing Iraq are all still unresolved. That's why I think there's a significant chance that this whole thing could fall apart and lead to a really big, messy civil war in Iraq that easily could become a regional war.
Hasn't the United States been applying some diplomatic pressure to reinstate those candidates? Is that a way of revealing that we feel we made a terrible decision with our de-Ba'athification plan in the early part of the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a widespread recognition inside the U.S. government, especially now, that the plan to go in and transform Iraq into a beacon of a democracy that would then change the Middle East was an absurd plan with absurdly grandiose goals. So the United States has considerably ratcheted back on its goals. All it really wants now is to get out of Iraq more or less with its honor and pride intact and leave behind a country that hopefully is somewhat stable, perhaps democratic, and not too pro-Iranian. So we've really lowered our goals. The question is, even are even those goals attainable? We don't know. This is why I think 2010 is a turning point in the war. I think like two other years were 2003 and 2006. All the problems, as I said, that faced Iraq before the surge are still there. Those are in some. How do you share oil revenue? What's the relationship between the major groups? What's the disposition of the big cities that, like Kirkuk that the Kurds claim? What's the role of Iran? And perhaps most significantly, will Iraq have a strong central government or be a loose confederation? The only thing that's changing in the equation this year is that American influence, both military and diplomatic, is declining rapidly. That is significant because it was American influence back in 06 that stopped the Civil War. So everything is the same except the one thing that intervened last time is not going to be able to intervene this time if things go haywire.
Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki accused the American ambassador to Iraq of interfering with domestic politics.
Yeah. We have about 100,000 troops there. We've lost a lot of blood and treasure and credibility there. Yeah, the Americans do have an interest. We intervened in Iraqi politics when we helped Maliki become prime minister. We have a dog in this fight. As my friend Bing West says, we are the strongest tribe in Iraq. The problem is the strongest tribe wants to leave, and so Iraqis are kind of trying to figure out what's the post-American power environment. Maliki is making a bid to be that strongman, somewhat Shiite and probably somewhat pro-Iranian. This is the great irony, is that the country that the neoconservatives wanted to invade to change Iraq change the region into more pro-American is instead changing the region into more pro-Iranian.
Is it politically expedient for Prime Minister al-Maliki to be seen as standing up to the American influence?
Absolutely. And this is one of the problems, I think, with our counterinsurgency theory, which I think was generally very good and really helped improve the American military and political performance in 2006-07. Our counterinsurgency theory is based on British and French counterinsurgency experience, mainly in the 1950s and 60s in colonial wars. They had a different goal than us, though. They were fighting to stay in those countries. We are fighting to get out, and that means a very different relationship with the host government. You see this both in Iraq and Afghanistan these days. In many ways, our biggest problem in both those countries is the governments we've created. I'm beginning to suspect that the only way to get out of these situations is to be kicked out by the governments we create. Essentially, for them to survive after we leave, they have to turn anti-American. It's clear to me in Afghanistan right now that our biggest enemy there is the Karzai government, not the Taliban.
It is interesting that in the first part of the occupation, the French and the English experiences may have been more relevant. If you've seen the Battle of Algiers, it almost seems to predict what happened in Iraq until we had this turnaround and decided to get out. So
I think the Battle of Algiers is one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. I think I've watched it about 6 times in the last 10 years. Most memorably, after being out on a night raid in western Baghdad, actually in a neighborhood called Jihad, I came back to the Washington Post Bureau, and my colleagues were watching Battle of Algiers. It was a little bit of a busman's holiday. It felt like I'd just been in the movie.
A story last week in the Washington Post reported that Iran sees al-Maliki as being out of their control.
Yeah, if I were them, that's the word I'd put out, too.
I see.
I think what Iran has done in Iraq is a model of how to influence a country with a small visible footprint, but a lot of influence. I think even now we don't understand just how influential and how pervasive Iran has been in Iraqi politics and even Iraqi violence. I've had American officers in Baghdad tell me that they believe that they have seen evidence that's credible that Iranian operatives have been directly involved in the killing of Americans. There's evidence that a couple of British guys who were kidnapped a while ago were actually taken into Iran and held there. I think in the long run, though, that Iran may not be after political influence in Baghdad, which is a little bit like trying to hold a bag of cats. You're always going to have people siding for you, siding against you, and so on. I think Iran may be after more Basra. Basra is the biggest city in the south, second biggest city in Iraq, and is also where the oil money comes out of, where the oil exports go out. If you control Basra, you control billions of dollars, have a huge influence on the world oil markets. Don't forget that the very bloody war that Iraq fought with Iran under Saddam Hussein was about control of that area.
Now, Friday, there were two explosions that killed at least 40 people in a crowd of Shiite pilgrims in the city of Karbala. Al-Maliki blamed al-Qaeda and Saddam loyalists. Has that heightened fears of sectarian violence in the lead-up to the vote?
It has, and also the string of bombings we had a couple of weeks ago against hotels, where not only Western reporters stay, but also where Western election observers will be staying, starting very soon. I think that al-Qaeda senses an opportunity here to step back in, stir up Sunni-Shiite tensions, and I think they're making a bid to the Sunni community once more, hey, you were once with us, then you turned against us and sided with Uncle Sam, but he's leaving, we're still here, we are your allies. I think a lot of Sunnis hate that idea, but the more fearful they become of the Baghdad government, the more fearful they become that it's controlled by Iran, the more they're going to look around for allies of convenience, even really nasty terrorists like al-Qaeda.
I'm talking with Thomas E. Ricks. His book, The Gamble, has just been issued in a new paperback edition with a new afterword by Penguin Books. Why do you suggest that we'll have to wait 2 to 3 months after the vote to gauge its impact? Is it likely that al-Maliki is going to win, for example?
I think he will, but I've had friends tell me that they think he's weaker than I think. The key period is not the run-up to the election. You'll see tensions increase over the next 4 weeks because the elections are actually exactly, I think, 4 weeks from now. The key period will be the period of government formation, and that comes after the national vote, as they see which political parties won the votes, who has power, and how you put together a ruling coalition. That is key because if the Sunnis feel that they were either badly treated in the election itself or badly treated in the process of government formation, you may see them go off the reservation. You may see them say, you know, we tried your political stuff, you stuck it to us, the only way we can get political power is through the barrel of a gun.
Now, al-Maliki has told people that he fears for his life.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of bombings. I mean, not only the hotels, the government ministries have been bombed. And, you know, people... In Iraq, there's a real continuum between politics and violence. You have political parties that have armed wings. You have militias that have political wings. And so I think it's very easy to move from politics to violence in an almost Clausewitzian sense that war or large-scale violence is simply an extension of politics.
And the bombings, I'm assuming, are meant to send a message, although I'm not sure what the message is.
The message is, among other things, if we don't like what you're doing, we'll kill you.
My guest is Thomas Ricks. His book, The Gamble, has just been issued in a new paperback edition with a new afterword. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Thomas E. Ricks, the Washington Post special military correspondent, a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security and a contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. And he's the author of Fiasco and of the book that we're discussing, The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006-2008, which has just been issued in a paperback edition with a new afterword. So is the Iraqi government able to provide basic services to the people these days?
I think it is more than we realize. The question at this point is the will to provide services. One of the things we saw back in 2006 was the denial of service, electricity, water, safety, even the ability to bank. To Sunnis. And so when you heard the government telling you things like people in Baghdad have an average of 14 hours of electricity a day, what they didn't tell you was that some neighborhoods that were Shiite had 24 hours, some neighborhoods that were Sunni had only 4 hours. In the heat of the Baghdad summer, if you don't have electricity, not only is it very difficult to sleep, you can't refrigerate your food. That means you have to go to the market every day. That means you can be attacked on the way to the market. If the finance ministry won't open up banks in your neighborhood, that means you have to go to Shiite neighborhoods to bank. That means you have to be held up at checkpoints and maybe robbed by militiamen who recognize that you're Sunni and know you're carrying money if they know you're a merchant. So there's a variety of ways in which services can be manipulated. And I think that's a real concern both now but especially after the election. If you get a hardline Shiite sectarian government, with a kind of vengeful approach, it really would be a very bad sign for the future of Iraq, especially at a time when the Iraqi government has less interest, less incentive to listen to the Americans. Sending Joe Biden there, which is what President Obama seems to do, I think they find it very easy to blow off Joe Biden.
Well, Joe Biden had was talking about breaking the country up into three parts. I suspect that only one of those parts likes that idea.
Yeah, I've never really heard a lot of enthusiastic support for it. Even the Kurds are a little bit worried because they know that Turkey has vowed it will not permit an independent Kurdistan to come into existence. They're kind of, I think, cool with the situation now, which is basically they have autonomy. I am told that up in Kurdistan, you have to show a Kurdish passport. They fly Kurdish flags. They don't recognize the Baghdad government in many ways. But they're kind of flying just under the radar of independence. Any further, and that would be hard for them. And yet, the other major groups, the Sunnis and the Shiites, definitely don't want to see the country broken up. And in fact, have talked quite vociferously against that idea.
President Obama didn't talk very much about Iraq and the State of the Union, but here's what he did say.
As we take the fight to al-Qaeda, we are responsibly leaving Iraq to its people. As a candidate, I promised that I would end this war, and that is what I'm doing as president. We will have all of our combat troops out of Iraq by the end of this August. We will support the Iraqi government. We will support the Iraqi government as they hold elections, and we will continue to partner with the Iraqi people to promote regional peace and prosperity. But make no mistake, this war is ending, and all of our troops are coming home.
Is it realistic to have all combat troops out of Iraq in the next 6 months?
You know, I'm a big Obama fan, but when he talks about Iraq, it makes my skin crawl. That is just so full of holes, the statement you just played. First of all, there's no such thing as non-combat troops. I think you and I have talked about this before. There is no pacifist wing of the U.S. military. They all carry weapons. And in fact, what he kind of means is frontline combat units like infantry. I feel safer with an infantry unit in Iraq than I do with support troops who drive convoys that get bombed, or with advisory troops who are embedded with Iraqi police and army units that are in much more vulnerable positions. So the distinction between combat troops and non-combat troops is a fatuous one. The second thing, he says, I'm going to end this war. What he means, what the Americans hear, is I'm going to get us out of this war. But as Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who was the U.S. ambassador to Iraq when General Petraeus was the top general there, Crocker used to say, just because you walk out of a movie doesn't mean it ends. All it means is you don't know what's happening in the movie. And I think that's the situation we're going to be in. We're going to leave. We're going to cross our fingers and hope that Iraq holds together. But we're out of there. Americans are basically sick of this war. They're sorry it ever happened. They're not quite sure why it happened. They've kind of woken up from an eight-year-long binge. They have a screaming hangover financially, politically, and they don't even want anything more to do with it. The problem is, as Colin Powell famously warned, you break it, you own it. And in some sense, we morally do own Iraq. We're responsible for what happens there. So when President Obama says we're going to end the war responsibly, I still keep on wondering how.
Well, will he have to modify his withdrawal plans if there's an uptick in violence after the elections?
He may be forced to slow down the withdrawal somewhat, but this doesn't appear to be a problem for Obama. Remember, he threw out a major campaign promise, which was to withdraw a brigade a month from Iraq from the day he took office. If he had done that, we would be down to about 40,000, 50,000 troops by now. We're not. We're at about 100,000 troops.
117,000, wasn't it? Or is it we've eliminated some of that?
I think they brought it down a little bit. Last time I checked, it was right around 100. Mm-hmm. Now, the plan, and this is the scary part, you mentioned his withdrawal plan. His withdrawal plan, the American plan, is to keep the troops at about the same level until March and then bring down the troop levels very quickly, about 10,000 a month for 6 months. That plan was devised when the Iraqis planned to hold their elections in January. The problem with our plan is that the Iraqis delayed the elections to March. That means that just as we enter that crucial period of government formation, the 3 months after the election, is also when the Americans begin pulling out a lot of troops, and that's where their attention is going to be on. So just when you might need troops the most is when they're going to be getting on the bus home. And it gets even more problematic because you're your early big withdrawals will be made from areas that can take it, that are more secure or where Iraqi forces are deemed more reliable, more trustworthy. The deeper you cut into your troop levels, the more you're going to be pulling troops out of areas that are less secure or where Iraqi troops are not responsible or act in a sectarian or vicious manner. That means if there's problems with government formation, say by June they don't have a solid government lined up that Iraqis are more or less content with, that you'd be pulling the troops out of the dangerous neighborhoods that are insecure, which means that not only will we might not have the troops available to deal with the problem, our withdrawals might be adding to the problem.
Well, you write that the concept of a democracy in Iraq is unfeasible. So what kind of government do you imagine will emerge as the United States draws down its forces?
I think you're going to see sectarian rule. I think it's going to be not particularly democratic, not just in the sense of obeying election laws, but also in the sense of obeying the rule of law with equal justice for different groups. I'd be very surprised if 5 or 10 years from now Iraq is stable, democratic, or pro-American.
My guest is Thomas E. Ricks, who joins us again to talk about his book, The Gamble, General Petraeus, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, which was published in hardcover last year and was a bestseller, now available in paperback with a new afterword. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Haven't American military officials been unwilling to discuss Iran's influence in Iraq with you?
Well, they are. They're very nervous about it, but partly because they don't really know. I think Iran has been very effective in its operations in Iraq, and we have never really had a good handle on it, even from the beginning. I've been stewing about this ever since I was in a convoy back in the spring of 04 from Bakuba down to Najaf. It was a brigade-sized movement, which was a large convoy of about 300 vehicles, a lot of heavy trucks carrying tanks and so on. And as we were heading southwest down toward Najaf, the bridges in front of the convoy, a few miles out, were being hit by explosions. And that really stunned me because this was an area that was heavily Shiite. It was really Muqtada al-Sadr's territory. And I didn't think that Muqtada al-Sadr, he's the radical Shiite cleric, I didn't think he had that kind of ability to carry out this very complex and difficult military task, to track an American convoy, figure out where it's going, get to the bridges ahead of the convoy with people who had explosives and had the knowledge of how to use them. That's a very difficult command and control task. And I remember thinking, like, wow, you know, I thought Muqtada al-Sadr was basically Al Sharpton with heavy weapons. And instead, this is a very sophisticated military task. At the time, I thought, wow, they must have had some sort of deal with the Sunni insurgents. In retrospect, I think I was wrong. It almost certainly was Iranian forces, either Quds Force, which is the overseas or foreign wing of their Revolutionary Guard, or some other form of Iranian special operatives.
Do you think the Iranians will wait for the Americans to leave before they use the full extent of their influence?
I think they're playing a careful game. They want influence, they want power, but they don't want to be seen to be dominating Iraq publicly. They are happy with a weak Iraq on their western border that doesn't threaten them. But they don't want to drive Iraq back into the arms of the Arab world. They don't want to scare Shiites. And then they know also that in Iraq there are some more nationalist Shiites as well as some pro-Iranian Shiites.
Will the drawdown, the American drawdown, mean more reliance on the military contractors who've been so controversial?
I don't think so. We'll see. I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult for the military contracts to operate in Iraq without a lot of American forces around. They're very unpopular with a lot of Iraqis, including inside the government. They've been seen as abusive, arrogant, irresponsible, and unlike the American military, not willing to really listen. For the last couple of years in Iraq, there really was a change. I was at a meeting recently of some American military officers and some Iraqis discussing the surge period. And the Americans were talking about how they changed their approach to Iraq, how they changed their use of troops, they changed their counterinsurgency philosophy and so on. And one of the Iraqis present said, no, time out. I'll tell you what the difference was. In 07, you guys finally started listening to us. That's the difference. I think, really what the difference was for American diplomacy and the American military. The contractors, the security contractors, have a reputation for not listening, even if they could understand Arabic, to Iraqis.
Now, Afghanistan was pretty much abandoned because of the Iraqi approach of the Bush administration. Now, President Obama has committed 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, although it took him 3 months to decide to do that. Does that commitment necessarily detract or at least distract from our presence in Iraq? Hello, are you there? I think we lost Tom Ricks, who was talking to us from Los Angeles, and we've been talking about his book, The Gamble, General Petraeus, the American Military Adventure in Iraq. It is now available in paperback from Penguin Books, and it has a new afterword. And do we have any idea what's going on? Well, let's take a little break and... Okay, well, we are talking about what's happened since that book came out, and with the new elections just around the corner, what we can expect. Hi, Tom Ricks. I was asking you about the fact that we pretty much abandoned Afghanistan when we went into Iraq. Now President Obama has spent 3 months deciding to commit 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Does that commitment necessarily detract or at least distract from our presence in Iraq?
I think it does in a couple of ways. Most importantly is simply the amount of attention that senior officials can give. I remember asking a Secretary of Defense once what was the biggest surprise in this job, and he said that you really can only do one thing at a time. You know, you think you're competent. He said, but the beast, the large sort of unthinking beast that is the bureaucracy, really can only deal with one major strategic change at a time. And you've kind of seen this with Iraq and Afghanistan. We paid attention to Afghanistan, then we paid attention to Iraq and neglected Afghanistan. Now we're back to paying attention to Afghanistan and neglecting Iraq.
Well, one of the constants is the continued presence of Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
Yes, and I think Gates is very competent. For my money, he's probably the best Secretary of Defense we've ever had. But it's not just that one guy. We put an awful lot on him. It's the entire machinery of the government. I'm not as worried about the military as I'm about diplomacy. I am so underwhelmed by the State Department, especially by the Foreign Service officers who come in, do one tour, and then, you know, get rewarded with a nice tour off in Paris or France or Paris or Rome or somewhere. You know, you see them with the U.S. military officers who are on their third or fifth or seventh tour in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're not going to be leading a brigade in Rome or Paris anytime soon. Because I kind of worry that the State Department people have never really anteed up in a way to show up and get serious about this, commit to 5 to 7 years of really being the voice in one of the American government in one part of Afghanistan.
Would you call the new focus on Afghanistan a surge of sorts as well?
Absolutely. Very much on the military side. It's more troops, but more significantly used differently, getting them out among the people, working side by side with Afghan police and army. That's significant because our biggest single problem in Afghanistan is not the Taliban. It is the Karzai government. It's the abuses and corruption of the Karzai government. If you have American troops working alongside Afghan forces, you won't eliminate corruption, but you will reduce it. For example, last time I looked, there were 5 Afghan security checkpoints between Kandahar, the biggest city in the south, and the Pakistani border, about 110 miles away. You don't need all 5 of those checkpoints. You probably need 2, one at the border and one outside Kandahar. So you tell the Afghans, you need to eliminate 3 of those checkpoints, and at the other 2, we're going to co-locate American military policemen. And they will observe and work with you. They will ensure a certain level of service and not shaking down each truck driver who comes through and making them pay a bribe just to get a truckload of rice through.
Now, we don't hear as much about Iraq as we used to, except for the occasional bombing in a marketplace. Is that because the media aren't reporting on it as much, or that the focus has shifted to Afghanistan?
Well, it's both. I think the media correctly sense the American people are simply tired of Iraq. They don't really think that anything much good is going to come of it. They're sorry, as I said, that it happened. On top of that, though, you've also had the collapse of the newspaper industry. Reporting is expensive and uncertain and messy, and the most expensive, uncertain, and messy form of reporting is covering a war in a foreign country. It's dangerous. Life insurance is dangerous. Providing security for reporters is dangerous. Even getting them basic goods like food and water and gasoline can be expensive. I mean, we used to ensure that we could drive around by having our staff buy gasoline on the black market, sometimes at $35 a gallon. That's what you do if you want to make sure you have gasoline in the car in case you need to get out of somewhere or get to an interview or something. So it's very expensive. And right now, what you've seen is a lot of media cutback on coverage. As far as I know, in the radio world, only NPR has a full-time bureau there. None of the traditional three networks, broadcast networks, have full-time people, full-time reporters there. CNN does. And a few newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, and McClatchy newspapers have people there. But it reminds me a little bit of the old 1960s slogan, suppose they gave a war and nobody came. And that was supposed to be sort of nice and warm, fuzzy feeling. It turns out to be rather morally ugly. You're fighting a war. You have 100,000 troops in the country, but nobody's really paying much attention. I don't think that's a good situation for any country, especially a democracy.
Thomas E. Ricks is the Washington Post's special military correspondent and a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, contributing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, the author of a number of books, Fiasco, Making the Core, A Soldier's Duty, and most recently, the one we've been discussing, The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, now available in paperback from Penguin with the new afterword. Thank you so much for talking with us again, Tom.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it.